Welcome to Why Wonders Why, a companion podcast to Smart Enough to Know Better. This episode is titled In a dark, dark wood, there was a dark, dark house. And in that dark, dark house, there was a dark, dark room. And in that dark, dark room, there was a dark, dark cupboard. And in that dark, dark cupboard, there was a dark, dark shelf. And in that dark, dark shelf, there was a dark, dark box. And in that dark, dark box, there was... We have no idea. This is a major problem in science. We just don't know what all this dark stuff is made out of. It's a really big issue, and we really need to find someone to answer it for us. Luckily, I know someone. Oh, I'm talking about dark matter, by the way. Sorry, was that too... Yeah, it was dark matter. We're talking about dark matter. Enjoy. For most people... When they have a question about the very essence of the universe, they just have to sit there and never know, or maybe look it up on the internet and be told by a stranger why they're wrong. But I'm not normal people, and neither is Dan. We're people who know people, because we're podcasters.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? Oh, no, I see where you're going. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, keep going.
I'm going to go straight to the top and find out. So when I want to know about something like, let's say, dark matter, I'm going to go talk to Professor Peter Quinn, astrophysicist at the University of Western Australia. Hello, Peter.
Good morning, everybody.
So, dark matter.
I'm quite familiar with
light matter.
Yes. Yeah, just so you know, Peter, you don't need to explain about like luminiferous matter. We're good with that. We're pretty, Dan and I, like solids, liquids, gases, plasmas. I wouldn't say we're experts.
You're educated.
But I've drunk a lot of them. I've run into quite a few of them. I live on one of them.
Some of my best friends are light matter.
That's true.
Exactly.
But everyone keeps talking about this dark version of it. What is it?
A somewhat embarrassing topic. Okay. So, because, you know, everybody for the last, you know, many thousands of years has, all of mankind's been looking at the sky and seeing stuff in the sky. And as we've gotten smarter and wealthier, we've built big telescopes and we've probed the sky in the optical wavelengths you can see with your eyes and radio and your X-rays. We've had telescopes in space. We've, you know, spent billions and billions and billions of taxpayers' dollars trying to find and understand what the universe is all about. But after all this searching and after all this money and after all this effort, it turns out that, you know, most of the universe is made of some stuff we have no idea what it is, right? So
So most of the universe is made of stuff.
About 75 to 95%, you know, is stuff that we can't actually see. So, in fact, the stuff we see is only about 5% of the universe, and that's embarrassing.
That's quite a big range, 75% to 95%. So why can't you have a more precise range?
We're very precise about the stuff we can't see, in the sense that we know it's probably two bits of stuff, two things, two rather important pieces. One piece, which is about probably 25% of the total mass of the universe. Another piece, which is probably, you know, going up to about 70% of the mass of the universe. So let me talk about both of them, because they both are dark, which is kind of mysterious in the sense that they don't, to the best of our knowledge, emit any radiation that we can detect, whether it's X-rays, gamma rays, optical, radio, whatever it is. But to the best of our knowledge, they don't do that. And so building telescopes is, while it's a wonderful thing, it's a somewhat futile thing, perhaps, for most of this, to try to directly see it, at least.
Because whatever wavelength of light you're using, you're detecting wavelengths that have either been emitted or bounced off this, the stuff that we can see in the universe.
Yeah, so exactly. So stars shine because they've got, you know, hydrogen gas, and they burn that and they, nuclear fuel, and they shine. There's radiation. Stars are made of rocks, but they, sorry, planets are made of rocks, but they live next to stars and they reflect the light. And so, you know, Jupiter's very bright in the sky, and so is Saturn because they're reflecting. So, you know, we can see lots of things that reflect, as you correctly said, reflect or generate their own light. This dark stuff does neither of those, okay, as far as we are aware.
I'm just going to kick in. I just want to kick in here just for a moment and say, to begin with, so it's not just that at one point someone said, hey, all those billions of dollars, how are you all going? And you went, oh, we've only discovered like 20%. We better say that we there's all the stuff we can't see. It's like being caught out by like a parent, like, who ate all the ice cream? Like, you know, there was definitely 90% of the ice cream left, and now it's only 10% left.
Ice cream in the fridge, which we know is still there. You just can't see it.
Exactly. So then you're going to have to be clever.
But hang on, you've made a comment then, Peter. I just want to jump in again, because we came to talk about dark matter, but you just suddenly said there's two things, which has worried me, because I don't even think I want to know what. Going to stop there.
That's, it's important to understand that there's a darkness, a realm of darkness in which there are two things which you need to understand if you want to understand the dark universe. Let's just call it that much, okay? So how do we know we're in trouble? How do we know we've missed the boat here on most of the stuff?
Because it's all dark. So why would you even know that it was there? It was just dark.
So there's a couple of reasons for this. Okay. So first of all, the things we can see, the stars and the planets that shine and various other things, we can count them fairly well. We can add up all the mass that we can see. And that gives us some sort of what we think is a total luminous, you know, see gas and that shines, and we can add that into the mix, and plasmas and God knows what. So we can put it all into the mix and make a mass sum for the universe, right?
It's the person who counted all the stuff. That was definitely a PhD student, wasn't it? Passed it on to a PhD student.
Yeah, a few of them.
Yeah. Hey, go outside tonight and just keep counting everything, and you just stay out there. I'll be having hot cocoa. Yeah.
It was okay when we only knew about 100 galaxies, but now we know billions. So, yeah, it's a bit hard. We need a few graduate students to count them, basically. So, look, we can count stuff up. Okay. And it turns out that's good. That must be the mass of the universe, you would say to yourself. So we then go to a friend of ours called Mr. Newton. And Mr. Newton, a long time ago, told us that mass, like the stuff we can see, exerts a force of gravity on all the things around it. And that force of gravity pulls things. And so when it starts to pull things, they start to speed up, and they eventually have some sort of orbit. They go around things, you know, they speed up. The amount of velocity that matter requires because of gravity is proportional to the amount of mass that's there in the first place, right? So you think, fine, good. I know how much mass is there. I can count it. There's all those stars and things. So I can compute, thanks to Mr. Newton, how much velocity, how fast all those stars and planets should be whizzing around. Turns out you get it wrong, and you get it wrong by, you know, a factor of three or four. Things are moving three or four times faster, maybe five times faster even, than you expect they should be moving.
And that would be, so I'm just trying to think, that would be a problem, because I'm just trying to think of an analogy. If you have like a car going around a tight bend, if it goes slowly, it can make the bend. If it's going too fast, it's going to flip off the road and crash.
Yes.
So the mass is moving so fast that, in inverted commas, flip off the road and crash. It would just fly off somewhere else. They wouldn't be bound together.
So the story is, yes, the velocities are exactly correct. They're much higher than you'd expect for the car to stay on the road. You know, they're moving, things are moving around really fast. In fact, you know, maybe things wouldn't stick together. They'd fly apart in some sense. Right. So why are things sticking together, not flying apart? And the answer is, well, if you're a complete believer in Mr. Newton, you would say, well, we've got the mass wrong. You know, there's more mass, obviously more mass than we thought. And so when you go and do the sums, according to Mr. Newton, it turns out it's about 10 times as much mass that's not visible than is visible, right? So that's the first and this happened in the 1950s. Guy called Zwicky, Fritz Zwicky, who was a Swiss astronomer, who basically discovered this. So, I mean, he's looking at galaxies and the way they buzz around, and he showed that they were moving around a lot faster than you expect if you just counted up the the light that you could see. So
that must have been very – when he did the calculation for the first time, he must have gone, no, that's so wrong. It's ludicrous.
Everybody says, I've just screwed up somewhere and I've got it wrong and, you know, this can't be right. But he – I mean, he's a pretty careful guy, and lots of other people checked his numbers, and indeed it was true. He was the first guy that said missing mass. He said there's something missing here in the universe. And so we knew we had a problem – because the velocities of all the things we could see moving around the universe was just too high for to be accounted for by Mr. Newton's formula for the things we could see. So that was the first indication we had there's something funny going on here. The second indication was when we got smart enough to figure out how the elements in the universe were made in the early universe. So in the early universe, we think we had electrons and protons, and they banged together and made hydrogen atoms, and the hydrogen atoms banged together and made helium atoms, and blah, 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 made some lithium, made some tritium, et cetera. So we figured that process out. And when we computed how many atoms we had to start with to make the atoms that we see today, the answer was only about 5% of this big mass. You know, we didn't, in other words, we got the stuff we could see shining was consistent with the universe having a lot of dark stuff. You couldn't have the universe full of hydrogen atoms because you'd make too much helium and too much lithium and too much everything, right? So in other words, to keep the fractions of helium and lithium that we saw today correct, we knew we had to have a universe that wasn't full of mass that we could see. It had to be full of dark stuff plus the mass that we could see. So there was
I'm just trying to think of, because you know, space is pretty black without things in there, even without not dark in the way you're talking about. It's just, you know, not. It could it just be a whole chunk of hydrogen out there, like spread a diffuse hydrogen gas throughout the universe that's everywhere?
Yeah. So the second argument I mentioned was the reason why we don't believe that, because even if the hydrogen was undetectable, even if it was spread thinly, we know from the way atoms get built, that if there was all this hydrogen there, we'd just have too much lithium today, or too much tritium, or too much carbon, or too much nitrogen, right? So we'd have, you know, we've got to do the mass budget correctly to get the fractions of the elements.
Strange analogy, but you would think, well, I in my bakery, I know that there are this many loaves of bread and this many croissants and this many Vegemite scrolls, but I also know there was this much dough. And therefore, that there's not enough. There would have to be so much dough in this bakery to make all these things. We'd have so many more of lead.
Yeah, exactly. If you said to yourself, "I used all the dough in the bakery," and you only ended up with 5% of the stuff that came, where's the rest of the dough, kind of thing? Yeah. So exactly. Yep. Good. Yeah. So we know there's no hydrogen out there. We know there's no stuff out there that would be the constituents of today's elements, because, you know, it would be too much of today's elements. We know how much we've got. So for that cooking reason, and for the reason of velocity reason, we know we've got a problem, okay, that we have more matter out there in and around galaxies that then we can see. And it's about...
Do we have this matter on Earth, or is this a space thing?
No, it's... Well, okay. So we believe that, you know, the universe, the galaxy, let's talk about a Milky Way galaxy for a start, okay? The Milky Way galaxy is surrounded by this dark stuff, okay? And it affects the velocities of all the stars in the Milky Way and the way they go round and round and round. And it affects them all over the galaxy, right? So in other words, the dark matter is all over the place. It's like a big halo. They call it a halo, which is like a big spherical ball which surrounds a luminous galaxy sitting in the middle. So this big spherical ball of stuff, the dark matter, is enclosing the luminous galaxy in the middle, and so it's everywhere. And so...
Well, hold on a second. I can see other galaxies, right?
Yes.
So if there's a big ball on the outside of those galaxies, then that means that it's not just dark, it's invisible.
We believe all the galaxies have this dark matter, yes. So it's all over the universe.
It's not blocking any of the light.
It's not blocking
what Dan's trying to say.
It's not a screen. Ooh. It's not interacting with
it's
the
not
photons.
Dust or...
The photons aren't scattering off it. If that were the case, we'd see it, right? So no, it's completely dark stuff, and it surrounds all the galaxies and all over the place. In fact, I think the I went to a conference just recently, and basically somebody said, you know, it's like somebody asked the question, how much dark matter is inside the earth, for example, because it must be some. Mm. And it's about the mass of a squirrel, basically. So that's you know, one gray squirrel's worth of dark matter probably occupy. Yeah. So in other words, it's very thinly spread, right? It's very thinly spread matter. But when you add
that analogy means a tragic end for the squirrel.
Well, I'll send you the cartoon that goes along with that comment. It's quite funny.
I'd like to point out, Peter, at the moment, you are sounding very Obi-Wan Kenobi right now. So it's a field created by all living things. Well, not like, you know, it surrounds us, it penetrates, it binds the galaxy together.
It does. You're completely correct, right? So, so, you know, and there is force involved, right? So there you go.
Yes.
So it's there, it's thinly spread, it's very thin density, but it's, when you add it up over the whole galaxy, it's about 10 times as much material as the galaxy itself. So the question that's been occupying, I'm going to talk about this dark gravity problem and the dark, you know, baking in the kitchen problem. Let's talk about that problem for a while, and then I'll come to the other dark problem, which is even more bizarre and mysterious. Okay.
Oh, good.
Yes, indeed. So as I said, basically, we have, as I said, a good theory of the Big Bang and the cosmology and the way the universe expands and stuff, and that theory tells us that, you know, if you look at the total mass budget of the universe, the stuff we see that's shining is about 5%. The stuff which is the dark Newtonian problem, cooking problem, is about 25%. And the rest of the problem is this other one I'm going to talk about in a minute. Okay.
In
this pie diagram.
So we'll solve this one first, obviously. By the end of this, we're going to solve the first one.
Stick to the first one. Stick to the first one. Okay. The other ones are much more fun in some sense, but this is also fun. So the problem is, and it's been an obsession of mine and many of my colleagues for all of my career, is what the bloody hell is this stuff? Okay. Yep. We know it's got to feel the force of gravity. That's thing one. It has to cluster, affect stars and things. It can't possibly shine. Another thing. So let's talk about some possibilities. One possibility, which is interesting, is that it's just rocks. It's just big rocks, right? So, you know, what the heck? It's just a big rock. Like the moon. If you just took the moon and you put it out in intergalactic space, it would be as black as black as black, because there's nothing, no star nearby for it to shine. So it would be a black rock. So maybe it's black rocks. Maybe it's black stars. You know, when stars go through their lifetime, they eventually run out of fuel, and a lot of the smaller ones just end up as a burnt out cinder in some sense, a big ball of carbon.
Like a white dwarf or a
white dwarfs, hot and they can cool and they become a black dwarf and then, you know, et cetera. So I was
going to say black hole. The only thing I was going to throw in there was could it just be black holes? We'll get to that obviously, but
we'll come to the black hole one in a minute.
All right. Okay. Cool. All right. Phew. Don't worry, listeners. I know you're all yelling black holes. So.
I'm
with you.
So rocks. Good. Rocks. Excellent. Okay. What's the characteristic of rocks or dead stars, for that matter, that's interesting? Well, one of the things is if you're sitting here on the Earth and you're looking out at a distant galaxy, like you were talking about before, nearby galaxy even, and it's full of stars, so let's suppose we're staring at some of the stars in this nearby galaxy, and one of these black rocks floats by between me and that distant star. Well, then of course, you know, it's going to block out the light from the distant star for a little while. Okay.
Yeah.
So
someone will definitely say, that's no moon. Everyone gets very nervous.
So this is all good. So you can imagine, you know, the bigger the rock, the more light it blocks out, or the longer it takes for the rock to go by and the longer the light's blacked out and things like that. So if you studied very carefully, the light from millions and millions and millions of stars sitting in some neighboring galaxy, and you wait long enough, some of these black things are going to drift by. And if you just watch the stars in the distant galaxy go on and off and on and off in some particular pattern, then, I've found the dark stuff. And not directly, of course, I'm not seeing the dark thing directly. I'm seeing the effect of it passing in front of some distant stars. So, the name that we give to these black rocks and dead stars is MACHOs, massive astronomical compact halo objects. There was a search done exactly like we just talked about. There's a search of telescopes have been set up and looking at distant stars, waiting for things to flicker in various ways. So I was involved in one of these projects here in Australia for some time. And we went for 8 years, staring at the sky, collecting lots of data. We had millions and millions of stars that we looked at. Nothing. So
zero.
Zero. So we found out lots of interesting things about stars, but we didn't find much about dark matter. So in other words, we found one or two things which were kind of flickering, but nothing. Mm. We couldn't convince ourselves that we were seeing anything like as much flickering as we would need if it was all the rocks. All the dark matter was these rocks of various kinds.
Well, okay. Because the asteroid belt is often perceived as being a bunch of big rocks,
but it turns out
to be like pebbles that are like hundreds of kilometers from each other. Is that the sort of shell of dark matter you're thinking?
Those rocks are pretty tiny compared to the rocks we're talking about. If the rock is the size of a star or a planet or something or other, and it's out there on the edge of our galaxy, it produces a signal, a blanking out or a brightening up, as it turns out, of the distant star on timescales of like a few months, right? So they're things we can see with our telescopes. Nearby rocks, they don't produce much of a flicker and we can't see it very easily, right? Mm. Very distant ones also, they're too far away to produce much. So in other words, there's an optimal distance and we figured all that stuff out. Okay. And lo and behold, there's not enough of these things to be the dark matter. So we're pretty confident, and all the way from things of the mass of the moon up to things of the mass of the sun, that whole sort of spectrum of mass, it's not there, right? So everybody was kind of convinced that the MACHO thing was probably not correct, that there isn't anything out there. You mentioned the black holes, and indeed, black holes do the same thing. They also block out light from distant things as well. So if there were any black holes out there, in the right mass range, we would have seen them, and we didn't. The interesting thing is there could be black holes which are a little bit more massive than what we looked at. And the people these days are quite interested in that. The latest news is that there's not enough of them either. But you're completely correct. Black holes are nice big black balls of blackness. Yeah. And so
pulling light.
Yeah. So they do a good job of blocking things out and doing things. So in other words,
the issue is that just to clarify for myself and maybe for the listeners, it's not that we're looking for things that are pulling in light. It's not the light's vanishing. It's what it looks like. Dark matter doesn't interact with light in any way. It doesn't get pulled into it. It doesn't reflect. They don't talk to each other.
It does have gravity and you can bend light with gravity, right? Yes.
So exactly. So these rocks that we talked about, I just talked about a minute ago, in fact they actually do to the light of the distant star is bend it. So indeed, you're absolutely correct. They do two things. In fact, they occult it. They actually block it out because they're occulting it. But they also bend it around the edges, right? So I didn't want to go into the complexities of that, but basically that signal, which is a combination of the bending and the blocking, that's the signal we were looking for. And indeed, maybe one or two examples of it, but nowhere near as many as you would expect if all that black stuff sitting between you and the distant star was in fact,
And a black hole would either absorb the light or bend it in a very savage way.
It would do almost exactly the same thing if it was a solid black rock. It would block. It would block some, and it would scatter some. It would bend some.
Yeah.
It would do much the same sort of thing. Yeah. So, scratch.
Not black holes, not rocks.
Scratch MACHOs. Now, as I said, the only thing, black holes still remain an interesting topic. The interesting reason why, just on this before we finish it, is that the gravity wave telescope. So these days, gravity waves are out there. So there was a big discovery a few years ago that the Einstein's prediction that the universe is full of, gravitational waves. Gravitational waves come from masses that move around. One of the sources of gravity waves is these black holes, particularly when they collide with something else, like another star or whatever. So the gravity wave telescopes have been detecting these signals from the sky, which they believe is black holes interacting with stuff. Right?
And gravity waves are not a type of light.
No, they're
like
not. They're
infrared or ultraviolet or radio. They're all types of light. This is something else.
This is a very different creature. Yeah, so don't think about it as light. It has to be detected with a very special telescope called the Gravity Wave Telescope, but it's more of an oscillation of the space itself. It's a bit bizarre. But anyhow.
So does everything, is it like a normal way? Like, is it like you have like, oh, this is going to be dumb. Okay, so you have, like, your normal shallow water of gravity, and then when the wave comes, it gets, like, everything gets a bit heavier and then a bit lighter.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely. So gravity is, rather than being, like, a flat, you know, smooth thingy, it actually has ripples as well, okay?
I think I've come up with a new diet plan.
So a bit very small. So the size of the ripples is 1 part in 10 to the 28, just – so don't get too excited about, you know, surfing on the waves or anything. It's pretty tiny. Yep. Right? So the interesting thing, the reason for this digression, is that people are seeing more of these gravity waves coming from black holes than they thought they would see. Mm. And so maybe this means there's more black holes than we thought. And one thing, well, maybe they are the dark matter because there's all the whole place is full of black holes. So in other words, there's a bit of a connection there between the black holes as dark matter and the black holes as gravity wave thingies. And that's, I know that's a story which is progressing. We don't know yet.
We don't know the answer. Is their idea more that they're not very big, but there's just lots and lots and lots of them? There's not like one big supermassive black hole, which there are. They're just saying there's lots of smaller ones that we haven't seen because our instruments aren't good enough.
That's right. The idea is that there's probably a fog of them, perhaps. Maybe that you know, was made in the early universe. I mean, people think these days of black holes being as a byproduct, as an end product of stellar evolution, you know, but maybe the universe had some cunning scheme in the very beginning that created lots of black holes, and maybe that's the dark matter. So that whole story is not converged yet, but it's an interesting one. But the general message here, the high level message, is that the macho thing probably isn't correct. Okay. So what comes next? What's the next logical choice? Okay, so what occurred to people quite often is particles, elementary particles, little things the sizes of protons, you know, atom size things. They don't shine as such, you know, they can buzz around like a fog of stuff in the universe. And maybe this dark matter is tiny, tiny stuff, you know, atomic scale stuff, not atoms like I'm talking about. You know, because we know it's not the atoms because the cooking doesn't work out. You know, it has to be some sort of maybe elementary particle we haven't seen before or something was created in the early universe. So people have been looking for these. The other things are called machos. These, of course, are called WIMPs, which is called the weakly interacting massive particle. So they're weakly interacting because they don't interact very much with the normal matter. We know that because that's what dark matter does. It's just gravity.
So it doesn't interact. It doesn't absorb photons and re-emit them.
We'll come back to that. That's a very good point. It doesn't scatter light. It doesn't. All it does is just feels gravity, right?
And is it? Is it like a subatomic particle, like an electron or a quark or something like that?
So let's talk about the ones which are kind of like the sizes of protons or something like that. The reason for talking about things that are that sort of size is because there are theories, and we have a theory of elementary particles, which is a very successful theory, and it does predict a whole bunch of fairly massive particles like the mass of the proton, which are part of this standard model, and we haven't really found them yet. So maybe the missing particles we haven't discovered yet are indeed these stuff that make up the dark matter. That's great. So how do you find elementary particles that nobody else has found? And the only attribute they have is their feel gravity and they've got mass. I mean, that's about all you can say about them. So what people have done, which is kind of clever, is they've taken big bunches of mass, like a big vat of xenon gas or a big block of sodium iodide crystal. We're talking many, many kilograms. We're talking tons, basically, of material. And so these tons, like, let's talk about sodium iodide. It's an interesting one. It's a crystal. And it's got lots and lots and lots of sodium atoms and iodine atoms. And one of these WIMPs comes screaming through this sodium iodide. Occasionally, very occasionally, it might strike one of the sodium atoms. And the sodium atom, because these particles are fairly massive, they're like the mass, in terms of particle masses, the mass of the proton. The good old sodium atom says, oh, you know, oh, that was what happened sort of thing. Sodium atom sort of jiggles around and vibrates the lattice. These, remember, sodium iodide is a crystal. Everything's right. All organized in various nice ways. And so the crystal, if you ping one of the atoms, it sort of tends to vibrate a little tiny bit. So people take these big boxes. The big chunks of sodium iodide crystals, and they look for the sort of ringing of some of the atoms as some of these WIMPs might have banged through.
So you can't detect the squirrel, but if you're walking down a highway and you've got a big net up, and then one of these squirrels runs into your net and then bounces off, the shaking of the net says this squirrel just hit you, even though you never saw the squirrel.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. It's a massive thing on the scale of an atom. It's a massive thing. And it occasionally bumps into an atom and makes the atom vibrate a bit. And that vibration is something we in principle can see. So again, it's an indirect, we're not directly detecting it like the machos. We're not directly detecting them. We're seeing the effect they have on other things. And so these WIMPs have an effect on other things. And so for the last 20 years or so, people have been building big blocks of sodium iodide and big vats of xenon gas and putting them into holes under the ground all over the world and trying to find evidence for WIMPs, okay?
Now, they're not bouncing off the material. They're interacting with it gravitationally to make them ring.
They're basically, because they have mass, okay, they have momentum. So it's really just like a car crash, right? In other words, it's basically, the high energy, and it's very, the chances of this are very small because they interact very weakly. So you have to have a huge number of sodium atoms to have a chance of seeing even one, right? So it's very, very, very rare event. Okay, but when it does happen, it's like two cars crashing, and this guy comes in here with huge momentum. This poor old sodium atom is just sitting there minding his own business, and he gets knocked, right? And the sodium goes sort of like this, and the WIMP just vibrates on. Yeah, it kind of goes on.
So does it knock into it like a billiard ball, or does it?
Yeah, like a billiard ball, correct.
Hang on. But I thought they didn't interact like that.
Very, very, very rarely, and this is where the thing is. There's one chance in a billion, or one chance in a trillion, or one chance. They're very weakly interacting. That's what their name says: weakly interacting massive particles.
Right.
But there's a chance.
Can I help Dan out a bit? It's because normally when atoms sort of run into each other in inverted commas, it's because electromagnetically, you have an electron and an electron. They're both negatively charged, and so they repel each other. It's not the masses bouncing off each other. No. This concept, they're literally running into each other. There's no electromagnetism. There's no charge.
We're not talking about charges. We're just talking about good old mass.
Just mass.
Wow.
That's pretty crazy.
Like cosmic billiards, if you want to call it that much. It's scattering is the proper physics term for it. So the WIMPs get scattered off the sodium atom, and the sodium atom.
And that's why you got to make bigger and bigger things. So if you say, I've got a bucket of this of sodium iodide. Okay, if my theory says that this bucket will get hit once every 100 years, I got to wait 100 years to get a signal.
Yes.
But if I get a room size, it may only be 10 years. If I make a swimming pool, it'll be 1 year. If I get a planet size, it's a day.
Exactly, correct. So you've got to have a big laboratory. You probably want to put it underground because you don't want anything else banging into the sodium iodide. You don't want cosmic rays and all sorts of horrible things. You want to put it under the ground probably and very quiet place, and you want to wait.
That's only if your theory is correct. Because if you go, if we make it out, if we make a swimming pool amount and we wait 10 years, we'll definitely get a signal based on my theory. After 10 years, if you haven't got a signal, then potentially your theory is wrong. It would be less accurate or less.
Absolutely correct. So you take all the care you can possibly take to make sure that the only thing that's banging into your sodium atoms is dark matter, right? Nothing else is banging into it.
What's the other thing that travels through stuff?
Well, like, there's
constantly
there's
bombarded with
cosmic rays. Neutrinos.
Cosmic rays.
That's the one, neutrinos. Yeah.
Yes.
How do you keep them out?
Well, you can't, basically, but they they interact even more weakly because they have very little mass. They get much less mass than these other guys, right? So the wimps, circle wimps, big, massive, you know, chunky guys. The neutrinos are the farty guys, and so you know they don't interact very much at all. So you take all the care to shield everybody else out. You know, don't have anything else, and then you wait a year and see what happens, right? So it's a very patient job, right? But again, around the world, billions of dollars have been spent by hundreds of laboratories building these experiments in the last 20 years. Answer,
right? I think,
that's so frustrating. Just as a bit of an aside, because I'm a human and I'm radiating heat and stuff, if I walked up to one of these things, is that going to throw off? Is someone going to be able to detect if I'm standing next to it?
Yes, it would, but you can't stand next to it because it's inside a huge vacuum chamber, inside a huge cooling system, inside a huge metal screen. I mean, you know, it's protected, ultimately protected from everything like people. One of the interesting things, they dig, they put these down underneath the ground because the Earth above absorbs all these cosmic rays and thingies, except for the neutrinos. But the Earth itself is made, there's naturally occurring like radium, so naturally occurring radioactive substances. And so you have to be really careful about this too, that even just the natural radioactive decay of dirt, it produces particles which can also interact. So you've got these people are.
If I
really
bought a banana in there, all hell breaks loose.
Completely correct. Yeah, you don't want any bananas or anything nearby. And so people have been super, 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 super careful, right? And they have spent 20 years and measuring, you know, more and more and more interaction, bigger masses, more sodium atoms, waiting longer, more sensitive little detectors to pick up the vibration. Yeah. And the experiments are getting more and more and more and more accurate. And they go down to what they call the neutrino floor. The neutrino floor is exactly what you said. At some point, you're going to hit the neutrinos, and then, you know, you can't do anything about them. But they're tiny. They're about 1/1,000th to 1/1,000,000th of the mass of these wimps. Right. So in other words, if we haven't found the wimp by the time we get to the neutrinos, then, you know, they ain't there.
And it's definitely not a neutrino then, because neutrino is matter that responds, even though it's very, very small, so, it's not the neutrino.
So you raise another skeleton from the closet.
Uh-oh. we're going to run out of time, aren't we?
So we don't quite know what the neutrino mass is. It's possible that if there were massive neutrinos, like, you know, more massive than we think, you know, they might contribute some component of the dark matter, but that's not a very favored theory either. So I'm not going to go there.
Okay, all right. Okay. We won't talk that.
But anyhow.
If you're a listener and that was your theory, then you write it and tell us why we're wrong. That'd be great.
Yeah, so it's got some interesting consequences, neutrino dark matter, but it's not, it's got problems, more problems than it's advantages.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. So we are going.
So it's not big rocks. It's not tiny, tiny particles.
So let's go.
That's not good.
Let's go even further down the list. Let's go to ultra light particles, right? Let's go. You know, you think proton is a big guy. Okay. Let's go to something which is around about a 1/9 smaller. Okay. Okay.
Right. It's like a billion times smaller.
Oh, like a billion times smaller, but maybe 100 billion times smaller.
Okay.
So why should we even be bothered to worry about these guys? So these are called WISPs, just for the heck of it. You've had machos and wimps, and now you've got WISPs. Weakly interacting slight particles, they're called. There are, again, these are really interesting. Okay. They're called axions, is their name, A-X-I-O-N-S. And the reason why they're interesting is they were invented by physics to solve a completely different problem than the dark matter problem. We have this incredibly successful theory of particles, and we can understand, you know, why they're protons and quarks and God knows what, and ups and downs and sideways. We know that, and then we got this really nice theory that works with. This theory, when you apply it to one particular problem, which is to do with a neutron, it gives the wrong answer. And there's a very few cases where this theory gives the wrong answer. It gives the wrong answer when you apply it to the neutron. And so some clever people some time ago proposed, well, one way to solve that problem is if there was an extremely light particle, called an axion. And if we had such a thing, I could solve that problem for the neutron, and then my whole big theory of particle physics would be complete. Okay. Fantastic. You know, it would be right. So it's a prediction, right? The existence of yep. these things is a prediction. It also, so that was done, they didn't know about dark matter, they weren't interested in dark matter. Mm. It was done to solve a particular problem in particle physics. Turns out that the same particle also is an incredibly good candidate for dark matter because it's produced in the early universe. It weakly interacts with everybody else. There's lots of it, you know, and it clusters under the force of gravity. And, you know, it's an ideal, you know, dark matter thingy, okay? Its problem is,
is it
very small.
Is it, and that's what, is it in within the realms of human possibility to detect it?
Good question. Okay. So the answer is yes, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So clever people to the rescue again. So it turns out that these axions, we might be able to detect them in a couple of different ways. We know that we can persuade them to decay or change from an axion actually into a photon. If you put give this axion the right sort of excitement, it can change from an axion to a photon, and that photon we can, in principle, then see. So,
how big is a photon?
A photon, like a photon, is a parcel of electromagnetic radiation. So, if I had an axion and I persuaded it to turn into a photon, that photon would actually be probably in the radio frequency, right? So, basically, the same frequency as radio telescopes can see. So, you know, megahertz, hundreds of megahertz, hundreds of gigahertz, you know, that kind of frequency, then we can potentially see it. So we find, where can we find the conditions in the universe where the axions might be persuaded to turn into photons? There are two possibilities. What you need is an enormous magnetic field. The thing, the persuasion, the stick that the axion speaks of, that, you know, frightens it into turning into a photon, is a very, 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 very strong magnetic field. Okay. Much, much, much stronger than the magnetic field of the Earth and things like that. The one place in the universe where we think we have them is in neutron stars. Neutron stars are the remnant star, the pulsars. You might have heard of pulsars. When a big star dies and it collapses, it forms a very dense object composed almost entirely of neutrons and spins around very fast. It's called a neutron star. This neutron star has an incredibly strong magnetic field, okay? You know, billions of times, tens of billions of times stronger than the magnetic field on the Earth.
Yeah.
So if the axions are wandering around and they encounter a neutron star, the chances are they might turn into a photon, and the photon then can be seen by a telescope. So people
so in the squirrel, the squirrel, the axion squirrel gets hit by the bat, which is the neutron star, and is smeared out into a photon, basically, that we can detect.
That's exactly so,
why I'm bringing it up is because so dark matter, which cannot interact with light as we understand it, it doesn't absorb it, doesn't emit it, doesn't interact in any way, gets turned into the thing that it doesn't interact with in any way.
So axions don't like to do this because they're not strongly interacting. You have to persuade them very strongly. Okay, so if you just sat and waited for an axion to do it by itself. Right? That would take you about 10 to the power 30 times the age of the universe. It's a long time. Okay.
Calendar doesn't go that high.
So the universe is what? 10 to the 10 years?
Yeah, so 10 to roughly? The 40 years kind of thing, you know, something like that.
Yeah. So you're right. We're talking a long, 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 long.
It's a long like, time. No. So axions are really what you call stable. If you're looking for a stable.
They really don't want to go.
No, don't want to do it. 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 But if you get the little buggers into the corner and you put a magnetic field onto them, they can be persuaded to do it. Right. Okay? And not very often there's a probability that they'll do it and all that sort of good stuff. So you have to figure out.
And they've got to be there. Like you can't, you wouldn't know that it was there. You put on a big magnetic field. Let's say you can make one on Earth, which we obviously can't, but you wouldn't know if it was in there.
Good point. So neutron stars, strong magnetic field. Love it. That's where the axion you come up. The really cool thing about axions is we might be able to do the same thing in a laboratory, right?
Right.
There are groups around the world, who basically have big tanks, big chambers, a few meters long, and they take out all the air and all that sort of good stuff, and they put an enormous magnetic field. I mean, on the Earth, we can actually generate pretty strong, not as strong as pulses, not as strong as neutron stars, okay? Mm. I mean, we can basically make about 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 Gauss. Gauss is a measure of how strong a field. 10 to the 5 or 6 or 7 Gauss field. Neutron stars is 10 to the 10, 10 to the 12 Gauss. So it's much stronger.
Okay. Stuff. But what's what's the Earth's field? I'm assuming like to the negative something.
It's like a Gauss of, or a few Gauss. You know, so down in
okay, the. Right. You, you, right. I see. Right.
Yes. So we can make. We have very strong magnets we can make on the Earth.
Okay, good.
NMR machines. NMR, if you go into an NMR machine, you're in a pretty strong magnetic field, and so we can just take that sort of technology. So we take a cavity.
But that machine wouldn't just pull the fillings out of your teeth. It would pull, like, the electrons off your atoms.
It's pretty nasty. You don't want to go there. No, exactly.
So you would be the squirrel in that case. You would be smeared. Yes. Yeah, okay. All right.
So you make a cavity, you put a very strong magnetic field on the cavity, and you put a radio receiver basically inside the cavity. Along comes a dark matter axion, mm-hmm. goes through your cavity in the laboratory, and in principle, you could create a pulse of radio signal and you can pick it up. So you can work out how efficient the bigger your cavity and the stronger the field, more chance you have of this happening. So there are groups around the world who are actually running experiments exactly of this kind. The big one called the Axion Dark Matter Experiment in Washington, University of Washington. It's one of the big ones. So people have been doing, as well as the people looking for WIMPs down tunnels, and now people looking for axions in these big experiments.
I love the idea that you meet one of these people in a bar and you say, hey, hi, what do you do? And I look at nothing. Oh, what? I make a big cavity full of nothing, and I fill it full of a field, which is nothing, and I wait for nothing to come through and produce a radio wave, which is so weak, it's basically nothing. And they go, I'm going to go somewhere else now. I'm going to stand over there.
So let me get this straight. You're looking for something that you can't see.
So, yeah, that's right.
That's right. You're looking for something you can't see. Absolutely correct. It can be demoralizing, I guess, but people are motivated. This is a Stockholm kind of class event here. If we find something, right?
As in Nobel Prize?
As in gold medals, I think, yes.
Right. Okay. Right.
So there are serious groups around the world who are looking for axions in cavities. There are serious radio astronomy groups who are using telescopes to look at neutron stars and things. They're all plugging away at there's a possible range of these axions in terms of their mass. You know, we know it's about a factor of 1,000, actually. It's quite big. So we have to plug away and look at all the various parts of that parameter space. But so far, right? So,
Damn it.
Yeah. So,
Has there been any false positives? Like anyone going, I think we found it. And they go, oh, we didn't.
Yes.
That would be close.
A good segue. So we're all demoralized. We'll go to conferences and cry on each other's shoulder and drink beer and things. but it's a great, great challenge to find, because it's a big chunk of the universe we haven't seen. Going back to the WIMP story for the moment, in particular the sort of iodide story, there is one experiment in the world called the Dharma experiment, which is based in a laboratory in down a mine shaft in Italy, actually, of all places. It has seen a signal, which is interesting. So what is the signal it's seen? Here is the sun, and here is the Earth going around the sun, and the sun is moving through the galaxy. Right? So the sun is moving through this sea of dark matter, effectively.
Right. So okay. Yep.
Yeah, and the Earth is going around like this. So it means when the Earth
goes in an orbit around the sun.
So,
yep.
Yeah. So exactly. So when the Earth is going one way, like with the flow, or when it's going
the direction that the sun is traveling through the galaxy.
Yes, or opposite to the direction, you should then see more dark matter hitting you. It's like the umbrella and the rain. If you're going into the dark matter flow, you see more, and if you're going away, you see less. Okay. So in other words, there should be a
didn't realize that that's how it was. I thought, because I keep seeing In fact, I saw this a couple of days ago, is someone where the planets were rotating around the sun as it sort of traveled upwards, like a big propeller. But you're saying that it's moving through the cosmos like a Frisbee disc.
Yeah, so the Milky Way is like a Frisbee disc. The whole galaxy is like a Frisbee disc. It has 100,000 million stars that are all going around pretty much all in the same direction, you know, with a particular velocity, which is too big, we know. And, you know, they're going around and around and around. And so the sun is going with all its neighbors going that way. And the Earth is along for the
ride.
And
the dark matter isn't moving with, rotating with the rest of the matter.
We believe the dark matter is basically static. Okay.
Okay, so, that's the important thing.
So there's
I'm going to be really rude here to the professor here for a moment and say, this is sounding very much like luminiferous ether, the Morley-Michelson experiment, where they were looking for the thing that light traveled through and they discovered that it wasn't there.
Exactly correct. You're completely correct. It is the effect of the Earth's motion on the signal. And there is effect of the Earth's motion on the dark. If these wimps are banging into...
I need to clarify this, but we're not saying, because that was looking for the stuff that light traveled through, because it didn't realize light was its own carrier.
Yeah.
So we're not saying it's luminous ether, but we are saying that dark matter is a anti-luminiferous ether.
Well, it's a fog.
That makes sense.
in which the stars are all moving through this stuff.
Yeah. Okay, right.
So there's a flux of it going by you, okay? So if you're going with the flux or against the flux, you see a different velocity, for example, of the dark material. So what this means is, over a 12-month period, if you were to detect a signal from a WIMP, it would oscillate, right? Because as you're going into it and away from it and into it and away from it. Good.
On a sine wave, no doubt.
On a sine wave, no doubt. Exactly.
Right.
So lo and behold, these Dharma people have seen a sine wave. Okay. So their equipment is basically measuring sort of noise, right? You know, they're looking for the jiggle, and they see the jiggle as kind of a noise. But lo and behold, this sort of noise is going up and down and up and down, up and down. Now, of course, there's lots of things that go up and down in a 12-month time.
Yes.
Right? The seasons and the oceans and the temperature of the planet and, you know, all sorts of good things. So, in other words, it would be pretty easy to generate a false signal which has a period of exactly 1 year, right? So the question is this real? And a lot of other experiments that have similar setups have not seen this, right? So it's this particular experiment that has this particular result.
Right, yeah. So that's a good point. So they're like, we've got a signal. Now, if someone go find a similar laboratory, tell them your results and say, look for this, and they're not finding it. The other laboratories aren't finding it.
So the other laboratories aren't finding it, but all the other laboratories are actually in the Northern Hemisphere. So wouldn't it be nice if there was an experiment like this one, but it was in the Southern Hemisphere? So that would mean it would be exactly the opposite signal, because it's, you know, the Southern Hemisphere is
Away.
Because it would be, as the Earth goes around, you know, the Southern Hemisphere is 6 months behind the Northern Hemisphere in some sense, in terms of seasons and things.
Mm.
So that's cool. So in Australia, we are doing exactly this. So there is an experiment funded, which is going to be built in Stawell in Victoria, in the old gold mines there in Stawell, which is going to look for same setup, same sodium iodide thingy, look for this Dharma signal. And if it's 6 months out of phase, we're all happy.
It'll be the opposite. It'll be out of phase. Basically.
So I mean, I think the suspicion of everybody is that they won't see anything, because other experiments.
Oh my God. How do you convince? That is so hard to give. You're talking a lot of money to build this, and it's useful science. I get it, but in the back of your mind, you have to go to a funder, a government, or a private entity with a lot of money, and say, "Hi, this is not likely to work, but I still need $150 million or $150 billion.
Yeah. So
that must be hard.
Not as hard as you might think. So the technology that they develop to do these experiments is pretty cutting edge, right? Mm. So in other words, it's a technology spin-off for sure. Okay, number one.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Number two is that setting up underground laboratories is a particularly interesting thing to be doing right now, because it may be that some of the most delicate parts of quantum computers can only be built in such laboratories. So, yeah, so there's lots of motivation for building underground laboratories.
I see. So it's one part of – you're not just doing this one thing. You're not just going to stare at an empty container.
No, you're setting
it's,
up a
it's useful for lots of things.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's an underground,
clever people.
Underground physics laboratory. One of its experiments is dark matter.
Got it. That makes more sense. Yeah, okay. I see that. I can see that makes more sense. Yeah. It's a hard sell.
So synopsis right now is, you know, macho's wimps, wisps. You know, we're not batting score is 0 out of 3. so we just, you know, and we just need to keep on looking, right? Because, you know, I'm a real believer in the lamppost analogy, right? So you only look where you've got a lamp, right? You can't look in the dark. Mm-hmm. And so machos were kind of a lamp and wimps are kind of a wisp. We've got lamps, we've got cavities and telescopes and God knows what we can use as our lampposts to look in the darkness and to find this stuff. And we just need to find more lamps. You know, we're pretty clever people. We're good at finding lamps, but we need to be persistent as well. We haven't got to the neutrino floor yet for the wimps. We haven't got, we haven't covered the entire parameter space for the axions. So we just need to keep on going. It's there somewhere.
You have to really, because that squirrel really doesn't want to get seen. So you have to keep just light up the room. It just keeps darting around. It's not sitting still.
Yeah. So I'm
going to call you out, Professor Peter Quinn, and all of your ilk. So even Zwicky, who you mentioned before, could it just be that you stuffed up maths? Could it just be the maths is wrong?
Yeah,
Newton was wrong, and Einstein, it's just wrong. Would you just add in like a cosmological constant and say times 10, and it all works?
Okay, so this is sort of like everybody's worst nightmare in some sense. I mean, I think, you know, to be honest with you, going back to the beginning of this conversation, I said we were talking about the Newton problem, right? So the Newton problem is the problem we've been talking about for the last hour or so. So it assumes Newton's correct, right?
Mm.
If he wasn't correct, and then Einstein's not correct in some sense, because those two theories are the same theory at some level, you know, it means that we've got something wrong with our physics. Now, I'm not saying that's impossible, that we've been proven wrong in the past about many things. The issue is we have some incredibly successful theories in science. The Einstein theory of gravitation is probably one of the most impressive theories that we have. And so to say that it's got something broken in there, it's probably the last resort. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we're that desperate just yet. Some people, you know, run to that immediately and say, oh, yeah, Einstein's wrong, and therefore, you know, we need a new theory of gravity and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I think we need to work a bit more, a bit harder on the Newtonian kind of world and see if we can find this silly thing because it would be, you know, a real revolution. It will be a complete, I mean, and in fact, if it was the axion, for example, you know, it would solve two big physics problems at once, which is fantastic. So yeah, I think there's lots of motivation to do it and lots of people who are still spending a large amount of money and a large amount of time trying to get there.
Absolutely. Now, Professor Quinn, you were talking before about the second thing, which is even more mysterious, but I'm just going to say, we've been chatting for an hour now.
Yes.
Should we just dangle that as for something to come back in the future and talk about?
I'm happy for it to dangle. It's an interesting, very interesting problem. It's a so-called dark energy problem.
And oh, no.
It has lots of interesting consequences.
And it's more upsetting and confusing and weird than what we've been talking about the last hour.
Strangely, it's not. It's actually a beautiful confirmation of our picture of the universe. Our picture of the universe requires the thing to exist, but exactly what it means and how we find it is another question.
All right.
Sounds like it involves wizards.
Huh? It's science at its most beautiful in the sense that, you know, to solve all the problems of our theory, we need a thing called dark energy, and it has to have the following properties. And lo and behold, when you put that into the theory, everything works magnificently well. So, you know, it's a beautiful thing. We know it's there, has to be there for beauty's sake, if nothing else. But we don't yet have any idea where it came from. So that's an evolving story.
All right. Well, then we will come back in the future and we will ask more. Cause my head is full. I'm just going to admit right now that I'd never even heard of wisps before. I've heard of machos in passing and wimps in passing. Wisps is all new for me. This is all very, and the squirrel thing, I don't know where that came from.
I thought they were all the names of bathrooms at some of the nightclubs I go to.
Yeah. No, it's people like acronyms, and there we are.
If one thing astrophysics are good at beyond astrophysics is really fun names. Professor Peter Quinn, thank you very much for your time. I do appreciate it. I'm going to have to sit and digest this for a long period of time. But yes, so thank you very much for all your time. Dan, have you got any passing thoughts?
Oh, no, my brain seized up about a quarter of an hour ago.
No problem. Happy to chat anytime. It's my favorite topic.
As it happens with so many of our interviewees who are passionate about their subjects, we ask to speak to them for like half an hour to 45 minutes, and it goes on for an hour, and we still don't even get to the end of it. So if you were interested in that conversation about dark matter and you'd like to hear more about dark energy, please let us know. We got into the weeds. Oof. Wow, we got into the weeds. I learned things. Hopefully you learned things. It was just exciting to talk about the fact that the universe as we know it is not the universe as it knows itself. It's pretty full on. Thanks once again to Professor Peter Quinn at the University of Western Australia, and of course to the co-host Dan, always bringing the sparkle and the wit and the joy. Gentle listener, that is the end of the podcast. Be excellent to each other and try to stay out of the dark, dark woods. Or not. You wouldn't know. That's the problem. You'd have no idea. It's everywhere. It's inside you. There's a bit of a squirrel. Bye.